Very good. Now, I think the last couple of days, especially last night, I was talking about the issue of forgiveness, and I mentioned the day before about not collecting the chicken poo, only collecting the eggs. And if I teach you that, it means I practice that. So I'm only going to leave KK this morning with the eggs. I'm not taking any chicken poo with me. Because you haven't done anything wrong at all. So basically, you don't need to ask forgiveness. It's a very nice gesture. But look, you know, you're such great people, so I admire you, give you my best wishes, and so you don't need to ask forgiveness at all. You've looked after me very, very, very well. In fact, I've probably put on a lot of weight in the last couple of days. But the topic today, which these topics, I did request that you choose the topics rather than myself. And I did that because it's important that whenever there is a monk or a nun or any teacher who's giving Dhamma talks, they give talks which are relevant. And the best way to make it relevant is actually to get you to suggest the titles. And it's become my habit, especially in my temple in Perth, is actually to ask people, no, let me know what you want me to talk about. And even last Friday, before I came here, just somebody at the very last moment, you know, said, oh, can you please talk about friendship? Okay, I can talk about friendship. So I teach without any preparation. And the reason why you can teach without preparation is because you know your subject. It's one of the teachings of the Buddha. Someone asked him, how can you teach, you know, this Dhamma so well every time? And he said, just your profession, the man who asked the profession, was one of these people who made chariots. Now, what we call like a car mechanic today. And he said, can you give me a talk about car mechanics? He said, yeah, of course I can. Without any preparation, yes. Why? Because that's my profession. That's what I do all the time. I know it back to front. And the Buddha said exactly the same with me. Because I know the Dhamma back to front, I can give a talk on anything at any time. And so when you listen to people, what they want to talk about, and you talk about that, you know, from the point of view of Dhamma, it's very easy to connect and to tell people teachings which are relevant to their daily life, which is how I've been teaching for many years, which is why many people come and listen, because they come here and they learn the way, the general teachings of the Buddha, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, how that works out in daily life. And in fact, ever since I came here, that's all I've been teaching, Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. But in our modern world, you can't just teach the theory. People can read that in books or look it up on Wikipedia, Four Noble Truths, and they can get, you know, a much better description than a monk can give. But the job of a monk or a nun or a teacher is to take those teachings and express them in a way which everybody can understand. Now, one of the things which I found when I first went to the West, to Australia, when I started teaching the Four Noble Truths, now the first noble truth is suffering, and I never got past that when everybody walks out. Because Australians, yeah, we know about suffering, we want to find out how to get rid of it. So, very quickly, I changed the order of the Four Noble Truths. So I started off with the third noble truth, first of all, the noble truth of the end of suffering, happiness, nirvana, peace. And then people got interested. Any psychologist would know you, the first impression is the most important. That's where you can grab a person's attention. And so by starting with the third noble truth, people were interested. I got to the first noble truth later on. So by just rearranging the order, not changing the teachings, but rearranging the order, you got people interested. I said, today's talk is about happiness. Yeah, we're interested in that. And the cause of happiness, which is noble truth number four. And then sometimes it's unhappiness. That was noble truth number one. And why there's unhappiness? Noble truth number two. Just by changing the order, I introduce the concept of marketing into Buddhism, which is really important. Because I know, many of you know, because the sort of people who come here this morning, you know, you're more like the hardcore Buddhists. And you come here this morning because, you know, you understand Buddhism. It's got a wonderful message. And it's been a challenge to me and many other teachers over the years. How can we package these amazing teachings in a way which everybody can understand, appreciate and benefit from? So my job as a teacher is not to change the Buddhist teachings, but to learn how to market them in a way which is attractive. So if you're going to do any marketing, you know, you have to get your customer response. You know, do your customer surveys to find out what people would like to hear. And also just how you can give, you know, what people want to hear, but what will also benefit them. So in order, the challenge of Buddhism in our modern age is actually to teach the Dhamma in a way which people would hear, they would find fun, meaningful, and they would like to come back again next week. And if you can do that, you are packaging Buddhism in a modern way. Now, of course, there's another problem, and that is that in modern people, in our modern times, we haven't got much time. You've had sacrificed a lot, many of you, by you're going to be late for work today, taken time from your jobs to actually to come here. Most people can't do that. Which is why, for a long time now, every talk which I ever give in Perth, whether teaching on a retreat or giving a formal talk, is always put on the internet, on YouTube. And even 2 years ago, my YouTube site was in the top 10 YouTube sites in Australia. Now that's, you know, politicians, pop stars, sports stars have got their YouTube site, and I was in the top 10, which was actually quite an achievement considering that this is just Buddhism, religion. And the reason is, you know, because you can give teachings which are relevant, which help people, which actually change people's lives, and you make it accessible. So people, they don't need to find time to come to the temple. And they don't need to sit on hard chairs and have to wait until they can go to the toilet. If it's on your computer at home, if you need to go to the toilet, you can just pause, go to the toilet and come back again afterwards. And it's there for you. And it also means you can sit on your nice chair or your office, you can do whatever you want. And you can listen to it at your convenience. So because of that, you know, I was told by our webmaster that now in Perth we have 4 Buddhist temples. We have our monks' monastery, our nuns' monastery, our city centre where I give most of the talks, and the 4th Buddhist monastery in Australia is the cyber temple, the internet temple, the e-temple. And the e-temple is really, really important. Number one, it's really cheap. You don't need to have a big hall, which costs a fortune to build. You don't have to maintain it with cleaners. E-temple, you listen to the Dhamma in your own home, in your own time. It's really helpful. So now, what we are doing over in Perth, we're trying to figure out, you know, sometimes it takes a while to catch up. But now we're going for apps, you know, so phone apps. So that you can listen or see a talk on your BlackBerry. Because a lot of times people aren't at home. They haven't got a PC in front of them. So they may be sort of, you know, waiting at a bus stop somewhere or waiting at the airport and then get out their BlackBerry or their iPhone and actually listen and see a talk. So what we're doing here is we're keeping up with the way that modern people can listen to the Dhamma. And by packaging it and by putting it in areas where people can easily access it, we're doing this great compassionate service to spread the Dhamma far and wide. And because we do that, it means that people in very remote places people in the middle of deserts, in remote places in South America, or in countries where you are not supposed to be allowed to listen to any religious talks. People can get on the internet and download the talk and see it anywhere. Which is why that many, many people have access to the Dhamma. So first of all, I'm saying the challenge of Buddhism in the modern time is to make it relevant to the people and make it accessible. Now yesterday, you may remember after I gave the talk, there was a couple of Westerners outside and they were waiting to come in to admire the temple. And I went to talk to them afterwards, and to my surprise, the coincidences of life, they were from Perth, my hometown, and they were working in the local university, and you know, I know a lot of the professors there, in particular the professor of physics, you know, Professor David Blair. Now, he's the head of physics, he was the Australian Scientist of the Year a couple of years ago, so very well-liked scientist, but he's also very interested in Buddhism, as many physicists are, and I was a physicist. And when I talked to him once, he said, when he was a young man, he was very interested in Buddhism. And he went to Thailand to explore Buddhism. But all he saw was rituals and superstitions. And he could never find a monk to teach him anything about Buddhism. The monks were there collecting donations or giving holy water or selling amulets. And no one was there to answer his questions. And so he gave up on Buddhism. Now that was just one example of how in our modern world we're losing young, modern, highly intelligent, possible Buddhists because we're not making things accessible for them. Many people come to this temple, I'm told. Are there any books for free distribution for them explaining basic Buddhism? CDs? Can you not do that so that people who actually come here, you know, the English speakers, because this is an English speaking group, they can pick up a little book about Buddhism or a free CD so that when they come here, they're not just looking at the temple. If they want, they can take something back which might change their lives for the better. Sometimes the Buddhists are a bit slow in picking up the opportunities to help people. You may think, oh, this is converting people. It's not. It's being compassionate and helping people, spreading these amazing, wonderful teachings. But it is very hard for monks like myself to do all this work. I know you know how hard it was for me to come to KK this time. I was invited a couple of years ago, and I had to try and squeeze it in somewhere. And because I do travel around the world a lot, and I get complaints, you know, from my disciples in Perth. They say, where are you? You're our teacher. You're never here. And sometimes, just for a joke, my president, when I come back again, and I come back after going overseas, he says, who are you? I say, I'm visiting one. But sometimes you wonder why do a monk like me have to travel around a lot? Because where are the monks in Malaysia? Now, where are the monks from Sabah doing this job? Where are the nuns? About 10 years ago, when I first went to Singapore, I was given a tour around the different temples. And I went to the Burmese temple. And at the gate, at the entrance there, was a Buddhist monk. A Burmese Theravada monk, giving holy water and collecting donations, collecting ang pao. And I thought, that's a bit strange for a monk to do that. When I went upstairs, there was a lay person teaching meditation. And I thought, hang on, you two are in the wrong position. The lay person should be collecting donations and doing the meditation. Monks, we should be teaching meditation. That's our job. What is going on? And have you seen that sometimes, that monks, they come to Sabah to collect donations? They don't come to teach. There's something very wrong there. So that is actually why, one of the reasons why there's a problem in our modern world. And I'm saying this as a monk, because the monks have forgotten their roles. Their roles is to teach. Their roles is to lead by example. Their roles are to inspire. And there are many very inspiring, very good monks. I'm only talking about some monks. So if you can, be very careful. When you see a monk or a nun, don't ever think that all monks and all nuns must be holy. If you want Buddhism to continue and to thrive in our world, you know, you have to be, unfortunately, a bit discriminatory. And look after the good monks and the good nuns. Encourage them. And even just, you know, quietly, gently to say to the other monks, please, you shouldn't be going around telling fortunes or selling medallions and doing all this business. That's not a monk's job. So to help you do that, part of a monk's job is actually to teach you what a good monk should do, what the duties are, and what the Vinaya states. And sometimes it's very good to have monks teach you about not just Dhamma, but about the rules for monks, so you can know what a good monk is. And when you know what a good monk is, you can encourage other good monks. Now another challenge, you know, for our modern age is, and this, you know, is in the West, but it's also in the East as well. In our modern world, there are far too many divisions. Divisions between races, and you know that very well in Malaysia. And the last year I was asked to give a talk on muhibah. You know the word muhibah? It's a Malay word which I learned, which means actually working together. It's like religious harmony. And that's really important. But it's not just religious harmony, it's what they call intra-religious harmony. In other words, harmony within Buddhism. And you know, nothing is more inspiring to the lay community to see that monks and nuns from all the traditions working together in harmony. Yes, you are the English-speaking group. I don't know if you're Theravada or what you are. But if the challenge for Buddhism in our modern age is to try and work together, and never to say my group is superior to your group, because in Buddhism that's called one of the conceits. The Buddha taught three conceits, three wrong ways of thinking. And those three conceits are, I am better. The second conceit is, I am worse. And the third conceit is, I am the same. The Buddha was just so wise, he saw that each one of those are conceits. You aren't better. You aren't worse. You aren't the same. We're just different, that's all. But it doesn't mean we cannot work together. So, over many, many years, you know, of studying, there's one important thing which, this is going to be a technical point. There's one important thing which I found recently. As you know, about 2 years ago, I hope you know, that I really sacrificed a lot to encourage the ordination of bhikkhunis in the Theravada tradition. And to be able to do that, I had to really look deeper into the legality of such an ordination. And one of the things which I found, which I should have really known before, but I missed, that there are no such things as Mahayana monks, or Mahayana nuns, or Theravada monks, or Theravada nuns, or even Vajrayana bhikkhus and Vajrayana bhikkhunis. All there are bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. Their ordination means they're in the monastic lineage. They are Sangha, as they say. And it does not matter, according to the Vinaya, what lineage you are born into, what lineage you're ordained into. So really, all there ever was and ever is a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni, a monk, a Buddhist monk, who happens to follow Theravada, who happens to follow Mahayana, who happens to follow Vajrayana. But first and foremost, They are monks, and Buddhist nuns. According to the Vinaya, that's all it is. So because of that, the Mahayana nun who lives here, the Mahayana Bhikshuni, there is no separation between us. We are sons and daughters of the Buddha, and that's as far as it goes. The separation is just on how we interpret the Dhamma. Nothing more than that. And because of that, the harmony between the great Buddhist traditions was there in the beginning. It's separated out because of history and geography. It's coming back together again now. So you do find more and more monks of all the different traditions living in the same temple together and practicing together. Bhikshunis from all the different traditions, not caring whether they're Mahayana, Vajrayana, Theravada, they live together, they practice together, they respect one another. What we're doing there is showing harmony. And I've told people in Australia, as I told you now, if we as monks and nuns, leaders, cannot show harmony, then we've got no right to teach. You have to teach by example, not just through words. There's an old story I remember when I was a layperson. From the time when the great Indian statesman Mahatma Gandhi was a student in London. He was studying law and he was staying in an English boarding house. And one day the owner of the boarding house, this lady, approached Mr. Gandhi. He wasn't famous yet. And said, "Mr. Gandhi, you may have noticed my son is eating too much sugar. It's bad for his health. Now I've tried to tell him not to eat so much sugar, but he won't listen to me. For some reason, I don't know why, Mr. Gandhi, he looks up to you, he admires you. So would you mind asking my son not to eat too much sugar? I think he might listen if you ask him." And so Mr. Gandhi says, "Yes, certainly, madam, I'll do that." The days went past, and 1 week later, the landlady came up to Mr. Gandhi again and said, "Mr. Gandhi, do you remember that conversation we had 1 week ago, where I asked you to tell my son not to eat so much sugar?" Mr. Gandhi replied, "Yes, ma'am, I remember that. But he's still eating so much sugar." And Mr. Gandhi said, "Yes, well, I only told him this morning not to eat so much sugar." "Why did you wait for a week to tell him?" "Because it took me a week, madam, to give up sugar." Now that's a true story. Someone like Mahatma Gandhi would never ever tell another person to stop doing what he was doing himself. He had to give up sugar first before he would tell anyone to give up sugar. Now that gave him moral authority. Now that's really important if you're going to be a teacher. It's not just what you say, it's how you live. Which is why I invite people to go in my room and see how many possessions I have. Twice a year in my monastery in Serpentine, Australia, we have open days. And I invite our lay supporters. It's all right. Thank you. I invite our lay supporters, all the people who give donations and feed the monks and nuns for the past year, to please go into the monks' rooms and see what they've got. Search under the bed to see if there's any Playboy magazines there. Look in the drawers to see what they've got. And I do that knowing that the people will be inspired. Yes, these are real monks. Now, I'll give you an example, a nice personal story. Now, you know that I lived with Ajahn Chah for 9 years. And many people ask me, now, was Ajahn Chah an arahat, fully enlightened or not? Now, the only way you can know is by living with a person. Because sometimes people can give inspiring talks, and you find out that they are bad people outside. In public, they can put on an act, they can be like a Brad Pitt and, you know, just play the role. But are they real monks or real nuns, real teachers afterwards? So it was only maybe about staying with Ajahn Chah for about 7 years. And I was attending on him. And he asked me to go up to his private quarters to get something for him. Normally, no one was allowed up to where Ajahn Chah lived and slept. Now I was going up there for the first time and I was really excited. Now I will find out if my teacher really is a great monk or not. And when I went into his room, it was an experience I will never forget. I almost get emotional when I relate this story. He was a very, very famous monk at that time. The king, the queen, great generals, very, very, very wealthy people will be coming to see him, trying to make donations. But in his room, it was empty. All he had was a grass mat. No mattress, just a grass mat on the wooden floor. A little wooden pillow and one spare robe on the line. And I think one book. And that was it in his room. It was so empty of possessions. And that's where I made up my decision about what Ajahn Chah had achieved. It wasn't what he said convinced me. It was how he lived. Amidst wealth, if he ever wanted anything, people would offer it to him. But no, he had nothing. That told me he was a great monk. You know, you teach much more by example than you ever teach through words. Which is why in the questions about how the challenges of modern Buddhism, modern people are very skeptical. Because they've seen many people give inspiring talks and turn out to be fake monks or fake nuns or fake teachers. And that disturbs people's faith. When I was growing up in England, being a Buddhist, remember this was in the 60s and 70s, and it was so hard to find any Buddhists there. I said yesterday that when I found the Buddhist society in Cambridge, these were the first Buddhists I ever met. I'll just tell you one of the anecdotes. At Cambridge, the university, at the very beginning of the year, they had what they called Society's Fair. So in the old Guild Hall, every club and society would have a store trying to get new members. You know, there was the Fox Hunting Club in Cambridge, where you can dress up and chase foxes. And there can be like the Archery Club, you can have all the sports clubs. And when I went around there, one of the first things I saw, the Cambridge Buddhist Society. I never expected to see there was a Buddhist club in a university in 69. And I was so inspired. I went up to the young man on the stall and said, I want to join. And the young man said, this is Buddhism, you don't have to join. No, Ehipasiko, just come and see. Come and see for a few talks, and if you like it, then you can join. I said, no, I'm a Buddhist, I want to join. He said, no, you don't have to. I want to join. And I argued with him. I couldn't give him £1 quick enough. Because I really, really was excited. I wanted to join. And that man became one of my close friends, Bernard Carr, professor of physics at London University. He's just only recently retired. You know, I saw him a couple of years ago. So, you know, these are great friends. A lot of the physicists were really into Buddhism at that time. So it's wonderful actually to see and have the opportunity to practice Buddhism as a young student in a land long way away from the center of Buddhism in the East. But nevertheless, it is when I was there that I tried to go to temples. There wasn't many temples to go to. There was a Thai temple. There was also a Tibetan monastery in the north of, actually the south of Scotland. And I was very interested in that. So I went there to do a retreat. And there was a teacher there, a Tibetan monk, and I was quite inspired at first. He talked very well. But then at 5 o'clock, he changed from his monk's robes into a suit and tie and went back to his house in Dunfermline with his wife. He was a 9-to-5 monk. And I lost all my faith in him. Now, you can't be a monk or a nun from 9-to-5. Many people have asked me that. He said, I'd like to become a monk as long as I can have every Saturday night off. You can't do that. You're either a monk or you're not. And so when you really do have a real monk, a real nun, in other words, they live the teachings rather than just talking about it, then they are inspiring. And that's one of the problems, you know, with lay teachers. Lay teachers are great, but do they really live the teachings? They can explain the Four Noble Truths, they can explain the Eightfold Path, but how much are they practicing it? The same could be said of the monks as well. But every now and again you really get great monks and great nuns. You live with them, you check them out, you see how they live and how they practice, and you find, yes, these are actually practicing, just as in the time of the Buddha. And that gives you inspiration. Because in order to spread modern Buddhism, or Buddhism in our modern age, it's not just about conveying information. It's conveying inspiration. You know, one of the reasons you come here, many of you have told me you listen to my talks on YouTube. And many of you have read my books. Many of you have heard all my stories several times. But they say, no, we still want to come because of inspiration. And that inspiration can only be given by a person who practices the path, who practices what they preach. And that is something which is missing in our modern world. It's missing in many other religions as well, which is one of the reasons why people in the Western world are turning away from religion. They know the information. What they want to see is people who are actually practicing their religion. Here's an inspiring story for you. In Sri Lanka, about 10 years ago, there was a monk who would often give blood. But like when you give blood, they also ask you whether you want to be an organ donor as well. Now, actually, I'm an organ donor. I've got my little card in my bag there. So if I have an accident, you can have my organs. I don't need them if I'm dead. So you can have all my organs. So I'm an organ donor. So like many monks, they were organ donors. So he was on the register of organ donors. He was contacted by the organ donor organization. They said he was the only one who would match a person who needed a new kidney. Would he be willing to donate his kidney to this person who needed it? But the people who sent in the letter said there was a problem. The person who needed your kidney was an evangelical Christian who was going around Sri Lanka converting the Buddhists to Christianity. Would you mind giving him a kidney? And he said straight away, of course not. We practice metta to all sentient beings without any discrimination. If he needs my kidney, he can have it. And so a Buddhist monk donated his kidney to a Christian. When it got in the newspapers, sadhu, 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 at last there is a monk who is practicing what the Buddha would teach. Loving all sentient beings, even your enemies, even the competition, if you call it competition. And so he gave his kidney to the evangelist. Now that is a good Buddhist. I don't know if the Christian would give their kidneys to a Buddhist. If I needed a kidney and I was going around converting all the Christians to Buddhism, which I've done. Would they give me their kidney? I hope they would. Because that is a showing that this is inspiring. Somebody who does what they preach. And so to convey Buddhism to our modern world, it's not just about the teachings. It's not just coming up here giving a Dhamma talk. It's not just teaching people how to meditate. It's being able to practice meditation. Being able to live those teachings. To inspire people. Because inspiration is what our world really needs. Information we've got too much of. Inspiration we've got too little. In the old days, we'll look up to our leaders. A young man growing up in London. The police were so trustworthy. You know, the old English policemen? Somebody told me this story. They were driving their truck through London in the early morning. There's no one around. This was 20, 30 years ago. They're driving their truck and a policeman stopped him for speeding. But no, the policemen in England, what they said, they didn't fine the person. They said, sir, you know, this is 3 o'clock in the morning and you've been speeding. Her Majesty the Queen lives in Buckingham Palace. It's only 2 miles away. We don't want to wake her up. So please drive quietly. Off you go. Now that was really good policing. You know, the policeman was making a little funny story. You know, you're not going to wake up the Queen of England in Buckingham Palace. But nevertheless, please drive slowly. And so, of course, you know, he drove slowly so he wouldn't wake up the Queen. Now that's how to get people to do what you want. And because of that, the English policeman had such a good reputation when I grew up. And I think that even in Malaysia, you know that at that time, the policemen, they weren't corrupt, they were trustworthy. So much so, if a policeman got into trouble, members of the public would help them. And sometimes, who can we get inspiration from? We don't even get inspiration. We look for inspiration from our media stars. Somebody told me that Dolly Parton, you know Dolly Parton? She did an interview and she was, you know, she's a great singer, but people were asking them personal problems. Can you please help me with the problems with my depression or my wife? Because people actually look to such leaders as if they are wise in all areas. And she replied, look, I'm Dolly Parton, not the Dalai Parton. So we look for inspiration to anybody who's a celebrity. But they don't give us inspiration. They give us scandal. And wasn't it awful? When all that was left was our religious leaders, we looked to them, and all they gave us is scandal as well. Now that is the real challenge for religion in our modern world. Too many religious leaders, priests, monks, nuns, have done scandalous things, which takes away our faith, which takes away the leadership, which takes away the most important part of inspiration. So that's one of the reasons, the challenges for Buddhism in our modern world. Not to just get people who know the Dhamma and can speak it, but ones who can live it, can inspire other people. Can inspire other people to go much further than you can go by yourself. To inspire people to give much more donations than you can afford. To inspire a person to give up, say, alcohol or having mistresses, but it's a tough thing to do. Say, no, I'm really going to do it. To inspire a person, yeah, I am going to meditate. To inspire a person, yeah, I am going to become a monk or nun. I don't care how difficult it is, I'm going to do it. That inspiration, that is what's needed. And those of you who follow soccer, who's the most important person on the team? Who gets the most money? The coach. The highest paid soccer player is, what's his name? Ian Ferguson, the manager of Man U. He gets a lot of, is he? You know, Sir Alex Ferguson, the manager of Manchester United. Players come and go, but there's a coach who takes the ability of that player, inspires and leads, and draws the best out of them. It's the inspirational leaders. Those are the ones which are most important. So whenever you are developing leadership, when you are trying to get people to come and fill up the gaps because there's not enough English-speaking monks and nuns in Sabah, it's not just getting people who can give a good talk. It's people who can inspire. People who can actually uplift your hearts so you can jump higher than you've ever expected. You can run faster than is humanly possible. You can do things which are incredible, impossible. Why? Inspiration. That is the challenge for Buddhism in our modern age. Not information. You can get it on YouTube or on Wikipedia. Inspiration. That's what we really want. So you celebrate that inspiration. You too become an inspiring person. I got my inspiration from an Ajahn Chah. Please, you get your inspiration. If it's not from me, from other great monks or nuns. And then you'll find Buddhism does grow. Not only Buddhism, but the world becomes a better place. Depression disappears when you have inspiration. All that negativity of thinking global warming, credit crunch, you know, national debt crisis in UK, in Greece and Italy or wherever it is. All these problems in the world, cancer, kids not behaving, whatever it is. No. Go for inspiration. Inspiration raises your performance and makes you do things you thought were impossible. Sometimes even people ask me, is it possible for lay people to become enlightened today? You know my answer? You do it. You prove it's possible. Go on. In the time of the Buddha they could do it. Why not now? Go for it. My job is to inspire you. But if I say, oh, it's so difficult these days. You've got so much work to do. You've got your family. You haven't got much. What does that do to you? What would happen if Sir Alex Ferguson told Manchester United, today you're playing Barcelona. They've got much better players than we have. You haven't got a chance. You might as well give in right now. Would he be much of a coach? Of course not. He'd get the sack. Even if it was some small team, say, Sabah soccer team was playing Manchester United. Has Sabah got a soccer team? Kota Kinabalu? Say Kota Kinabalu soccer team were playing Manchester United. And the coach said, oh, Manchester United, Premier League team, you can't beat them. Impossible, just do your best. That's not a good coach. So the coach of Kota Kinabalu said, the ball is round, it can go any way. You've got two legs, they got two legs. You got 11 people, they got 11 people, who knows? Give it a go, you can do it, yeah. We can do it, we're on home ground, we've got all the supporters. They're tired, you know, they're just so confident, they're cocky. We're not. You can do it. Yeah. And they'll go out, yeah, we can win. And sometimes they do win. Why do they win? Inspiration. So please, one of the biggest challenges for religion, especially Buddhism in our modern world, is to be able to inspire people. Especially inspire our youth. One last thing before I open up for Q&A. A psychologist told me something which rang very, very true. Our girls and boys become very spiritual about the age of 15 or 16. They want to explore religion, spirituality, the meaning of life. Boys at the age of 14 or 15 or 16, they're not just interested in girls. The girls are not just interested in boys. They're interested in life. Their whole life lies before them, it's opening out, and they want to, at the early stage, find some sort of meaning, some sort of guidance, some sort of spirituality. And they're seeking some spirituality, some religion which is meaningful to them, which can inspire them, which can motivate them. That's why I became a Buddhist at 16, 17. I was searching, all my friends were searching at that time, looking for some meaning in their life. So we should address, there, you know, is a market, if you like, to be gross. People who want to be inspired, but they want a Buddhism which makes sense to them. Not just shaking incense and giving out medallions. They want something which is going to help their life. You know, once, or many times. Oh well, let's take the first time. I arrived in Singapore, and they said, oh, can you give a talk? There's a youth camp on. So I went to the youth camp, and I said, okay, boys over here, girls over there. And then I talked to the girls, and the boys were listening. Okay, girls, what do you like in a boy? What type of boy really turns you on? And all the boys were listening. Because no one had ever told them what they needed to do to be attractive to a girl. And this was really important information for them. So they're all listening. They say, no, should he really dress in expensive clothes? They say, no, that's not important. What they wanted, and I remember them telling me, they wanted a boy who was trustworthy, fun to be with, caring. They didn't have to, you know, wear expensive clothes or act like some sort of Rocky Sylvester Stallone. That was not what they wanted. And all the boys were taking notes. And then I turned to the boys. Okay, what do you like in a girl? You know, does she have to be like, have beautiful hair and lots of makeup and fine clothes? Now that helps, but what they really liked in a girlfriend, again, is someone who would be sensitive and care for them. Someone who's trustworthy. They didn't have to be like a supermodel. What they really wanted is someone who was sensitive and caring. And I said, there you are. You keep your five precepts. And it makes you attractive. You don't need to go to beauty parlor. You need to go to temple instead. And at last, the boys again realized what they needed to do to get a nice girlfriend and keep her. That sensitivity, that care, that honesty, that trustworthiness, that was more important than being rich. Wealth would come later on if they worked hard. But they wanted someone who kept their promises, turn up on time, someone they knew cared for them, who developed compassion. Those are the sorts of boys they wanted. Other things were important too, but those were the most important. So there I was teaching spirituality to a group of young people who were desperate to find a girlfriend and a boyfriend. And that's how it's done. So it's an example. You can market it in a way which they're really interested. And they weren't looking at their sort of iPhones texting their friends. They were paying absolute full attention. At last they were finding out, you know, what they needed to do to get to be attractive. So that's how we spread Dhamma. Inspire, make it meaningful. And then even our kids can find, wow, this is really good stuff. Which is why in Perth we get a huge number of young people coming to our centres, practicing, changing their lives, becoming really good people. That, I think, is a challenge for Buddhism in our modern world. That's how to do it. So, I've spoken a long time, I don't know how long, I've lost my watch, but now we can have questions and answers and comments. Let's make it a bit of a discussion. So what do you think about all the stuff I've been saying? Does it make sense? Oh, the lady over there, yeah.
Good morning, Ajahn Brahm.
Good morning.
My name is Doris Collard. And I have a question, because it seems that, it's not it seems, but you are so current in the affairs.
Yeah.
And I want to know, how do you get all the current news? Because I know in monastery you don't have any computers, TVs.
We don't have TVs. Get newspapers.
Oh, you do get
newspapers. Yeah, and once a week when I'm in town, I usually visit this very elderly couple. I've been going to see them for many years in the evening, and they let me see the news on TV. When I'm in Perth, I do that once a week, so I can get some understanding of what's going on. And that's really important for me as a monk. I remember Ajahn Chah, when his second monk, his name was Ajahn Lim, he's the current abbot of Wat Pa Phong. Ajahn Lim had very, very good meditation, very peaceful, very wise. And Ajahn Chah ordered a newspaper for him and said, you have to read this once a week. Because, you know, you'll be a teacher soon. And you have to know how people live and how they think. So Ajahn Chah ordered him to read a newspaper once a week.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry. Yeah, since you travel a lot, then when you jump into an aircraft, do you talk to your neighbors next to you or you pretend to sleep?
No, I try and meditate if I possibly can. And one of the reasons, by the time I get on the aircraft, I'm usually exhausted. Because this morning, I'm going to Adana, and then after the lunch, they take me to the airport, and they'd be talking to me all the way to the departure gate, making photographs. And by the time I get on the aircraft, I'm exhausted, and I just like to be by myself, a solitary monk. But it happened once, I gave a lot of talks in Malacca. There was a seminar, I did a celebrity wedding and talking to people. And they drove me from Malacca to KLIA airport, talking to me, asking their questions all the way, which I don't mind, that's what you do. And then I eventually checked in, and I thought, now I can rest on the flight from KL back to Perth. And as I sat in the window seat, so, you know, at least there's one side, no one's going to sit next to me. Then I was very relieved, a man sat next to me. And then a woman passed and stopped and said, are you Ajahn Brahm? I said, yes. Oh, I always wanted to meet you and ask some questions. And I said, well, unfortunately, there's someone sitting next to me. And so she turned to the person sitting next to her and said, would you mind swapping seats? And I was saying, please say no, please. And he said, yes. And so for about 5 or 6 hours, she got free counseling. And I had no rest at all. You can't, I'm in the window seat, she's got the aisle seat, I can't get out. So she's asking all these questions about her relationships, her marriage, her kids, and goodness knows what else. No peace at all. So actually that's what I like to do sometimes. I've got now someone, now I had a 60th birthday and they said, can we get you something? And I thought, what does a monk need? Well, actually, I thought of something. I've got these noise equalizing headphones. So I can put them on, and someone can speak to me. I can't hear them on the aircraft. So I put those on the aircraft. Makes it nice and quiet, like I'm in a cave. So that's actually a good gift. So that's what I do when I get on the aircraft. Yeah, next question. Comment. Yeah.
Good morning, John.
Yeah, it's working.
I'm leading the Aloha startup. We do have...
Maybe hold it closer to your... Yeah.
Various activity to serve the center, the members of the center in Aloka. I find that among Buddhists, among supporters of Aloka centers, people coming from different background, different level of understanding. So their needs are quite varied. Some are devotional in nature, some are intellectuals, some are simply social beings. They like to engage with social work. In the course of our activities, we do find difficulty in satisfying all needs, all talents. We look at it as our talent, actually. Where do we draw a line in running a center like this? Okay, my second question is, you mentioned about the use of new media, internet, CD, to facilitate those who have little time to study Buddhism on their own, like listening on their own. But that has a downside. This tends to isolate people. Human beings are social beings. They need to react. But they make feel closer to each other. In fact, the new media tend to isolate people. People tend to be very individualistic. Where do we draw a line?
Yeah, I think the first question about the different people, different types of Buddhism, some people are very devotional, some people are intellectual. And of course, I mean, all that is, it should be embraced by a spirituality. You're devotional, and to try and encourage people who are devotional to understand why they're devotional. For example, I gave that simile. When I bow to a Buddha statue, I don't bow to the statue not knowing what I'm bowing to. I bow to virtue, peace and compassion. And I can explain to the intellectuals that that has a very strong psychological effect. Every time I bow, I'm remembering the importance of virtue, peace and compassion. Which means I'm encouraging my own cultivation of virtue, peace and compassion, which means I become more virtuous, more peaceful, more compassionate. Because that's what I remember what I'm doing. It's a moment of mindfulness and recollecting the importance of my life and what the Buddha stands for. So you can take a devotional act and actually use it for becoming a much stronger, better Buddhist. I also, I think, mentioned that in my temple in Perth, we don't have donation boxes. We have letting go boxes. So in other words, we're taking the charitable wish of human beings. Now, we always like helping each other and giving. I like giving as well. That's why I come here. We do that, but instead of just calling it giving, we're calling it letting go. Thereby encouraging a very powerful part of Buddhism. The ability to let go of control which we exert over our lives through the possession of wealth. By letting go of wealth, it means there's less things you can buy, less things you can do. It is a form of letting go. And people who do the chanting, over in, I don't know what chanting you do, but over in Australia we try and translate the chants into English so people can actually understand what they're chanting. And then it becomes inspiring. You know, we chant the Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. You know, let them, you know, this, I'm just choosing phrases. Let them be content and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. These are great little teachings. And when we chant them in English, again, we're listening to what we're chanting. And after a while, it gets into our brain. And we actually become less demanding. People who are easily satisfied, who are contented, because we keep chanting that. So, you know, you really praise the Mahayana. For a long time they've been chanting, not in Sanskrit, but in Chinese. Hopefully it's in ordinary Chinese, in Hakka, rather than in a language or a dialect you don't understand. So the language of the common people. And then the devotion becomes meaningful. So we have to get the devotional people, and also the people who just like cooking and serving. There are some people, whenever there's an event, they come along, they like cooking, they like cleaning. And in fact, that reminds me of a story I haven't told yet. This is a great story for any Buddhist community. It's a story of the five fingers. Once there were five fingers, and the five fingers were arguing who was the most important finger. And the thumbs said, I am the strongest, the fattest, the most useful. And also, I am the finger which says, okay. I am the most important finger, strongest and fattest. And the index finger said, no, I am the most important. When you say the number one, which finger do you put up? Me. I'm number one. And I also, I'm the finger of wisdom because I can point out things to people. So I am number one. I am the finger of wisdom. I am the best. And then the middle finger put its hand up. It's erected itself. And the middle finger said, no, I am the tallest, so I can see furthest. And also, in Buddhism, we praise the middle way, and I am the middle finger. So according to the Dhamma, I am the best, the middle way finger. And then the next finger put their hand up, the fourth finger, and said, I am the most important, because I am the finger of love. When you get engaged, which finger does the ring go on? When you're married, which finger does it go on? Me! And compassion is the most important part of Buddhism. So I am the finger of love and compassion. I am the most important finger. And that left, this one left. And the little finger said, actually, you're all wrong. It is me who's the most important finger. And I'll tell you why. Even though you use me to do dirty things, still, when you pray to the Buddha, I'm always closest to the Buddha. So the little finger one was the most important finger. Even though they do dirty things, they are the closest to the Buddha. In the same way, it is the members of Aloka Foundation or of this temple, the ones who clean up afterwards, who wash the dishes, who mop the floor, who clean the toilets, the ones who do dirtiest things, they are the closest to the Buddha. There's a lovely little story of how even the people in the organization who do the devotional work or the cleaning, sometimes they are closest to the Buddha. So using the wisdom there. And with the use of all the different media, where should we draw the line? I think we should still be extending the line more. I went to a Buddhist film festival. There's Buddhist film festivals throughout the world now. I think I went to two of them in Singapore, where they are trying to get the Buddhist message packaged in the way of a movie, shown to people to get them to be better human beings. People will always watch movies. You can't stop them. And what do they watch? Sex and violence. It's exciting, yes, but at the end of the movie, what do you really learn? Do you go out of the movie a better person? So why can't we have a Buddhist movie? Which, yeah, entertains people, but at the end of the day, when they leave the movie theater, they get really wonderful messages on how to be happier, better people, serving the world, being compassionate, being peaceful. So I suggested at the last festival that I saw in the newspapers there's so many new superhero movies. Batman, Iron Man, Plastic, they've got Plastic Man yet. I don't know. Superman, Batman, Captain America, I saw that on the front page. So all these superhero parts. And I remember when I was a monk in Thailand, the first year I saw in a Thai paper, they had a little cartoon strip called Super Monk. And Super Monk, you know, he had psychic powers. He'd levitate, fly through the air, and stop trains from falling over the cliff, catch bank robbers. But when he caught the bank robber, he wouldn't send them to prison. He'd just give them the five precepts and say, you're forgiven, off you go. So it was actually a very beautiful message in Super Monk. And it was also, exciting. So I suggested to the audience, why don't we start a Super Monk movie franchise? You've had Superman, you've had Batman, now Super Monk. And Super Monk again has psychic powers, can read people's minds, can see the terrorist about to blow up the plane and say, I can see that you've got a bomb in your underpants. and say, please take them off. It's bad karma, you know, to sort of blow up people and then give them the five precepts and converting them or whatever. So they never do bad things anymore. And one of the people in the audience works for Steven Spielberg. He said, I'm going to tell him that. So that was around about 6 months ago. So, if you see coming out next from DreamWorks, Super Monk, you know where the idea came from. Why not? What it's going to do is going to get those Buddhist ideas to people who really need to hear them. So sometimes I don't know if we should draw too many lines. I think we should try and extend those lines with the way that Buddhism is given out into the world. That's my opinion at the moment. As monks, obviously, the monk would not star in Super Monk movie. I'd be consultant, but that's as far as I can go. And even like Buddhist songs, people have asked me, are Buddhist songs, is that all right? And I was quoting from the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, where the Malas of Kusinara, after the Buddha's Parinibbana, celebrated for 7 days with song and dance as their offering to the Buddha. And these were Buddhists. So they offered singing and dancing as their way of paying respect. So it does have a precedence from the time of the Buddha to celebrate, to worship, even with good Buddhist songs. So people like Victor Wee, who came here with his guitar recently, well done. That's a good way of actually getting Buddhism to be more available to people. But Victor is about the same age as me. He's about 60. We want some young guys with electric guitars who can actually start making that music. Why not? What do you think about that? Is that a good idea? Don't see why not. Because, look, you come along here. One of the reasons people come and listen to me, because it's entertaining as well. It's got a message, but it's also meaningful, entertaining. So you come along and have a good time. Because even last night and the night before, I was competing with the TV. People were thinking, oh, should I go and see Ajahn Brahm, or should I go and watch the TV? My favorite program is on. So to compete, you have to be entertaining.
Thank you, Ajahn, for a very enlightening explanation. Situation. But my question, second question on where do we draw a line between the use of new media and the role of the temple? The use of new media, internet, a CD, in the spread of the Dhamma, and the role of the temple. People tend to not come to temple anymore. But instead, they tend to be isolated. Where do we draw a line?
Okay, well, you made a good point, I remember, I haven't addressed, with like fellowship. The human being is a very social animal, and we like having friends. And even the Buddha mentioned it's called Kalyana Mitta, having good friends in the Dhamma. It's really, really important. But unfortunately, our modern life, there are some people who are isolated, and they can't do much about that. They're either in places. Now they go to work in some far-flung place or on oil rigs or in the middle of the desert or the middle of the ocean. And the internet is their lifeline. You know, especially in a place like Australia, this huge country, and most people just settled in a few big cities. And there's some places which are so remote. And people who are in those remote areas, in the mines or wherever, they say it's such a wonderful resource. They can get on their internet and they can listen to a Dhamma talk at any time. So it is not going to supplant fellowship. It's going to be there for the people who, for one reason or another, can't have that fellowship. But those people, they always say, they've seen, for example, they've seen Ajahn Brahm on the YouTube, but they want to see me live. So yeah, you can have your friends which you email, but you want to see them live as well. So fellowship will always be there. You maybe make those contacts over the internet, and then you say, you know, Ajahn Brahm is coming to KK, and then people come all the way from KL for that fellowship, which is very good, and it's a wonderful thing to have the noble friends. So there will always be that fellowship there. I don't think that the use of internet will stop the need for fellowship, especially Buddhist fellowship, to come along for good causes. It will actually increase the membership, enhance people's understanding of the Dhamma, inspire them even more, and at the same time, when they have the opportunity to visit, they will always come and join in. You can see in all that, somebody asked me last night about all the revolutions in the Arab world, you know, the Arab Spring. And we all know that all got organized on Twitter and Facebook. The young people use modern media to find that fellowship and to come together. And that's sometimes what happens. We had a youth group meeting, and it was on the last moment. They said, oh, can we use your center tomorrow? And they said, look, we won't be able to advertise in time. I said, don't worry about that. It's already on Facebook and Twitter. And so we've got a lot of people turning up. That's how young people organize themselves today. That's how they get members coming. This talk was on Twitter and Facebook? From Facebook. That's how you actually contact people. That's how you get the social networking. So if Buddhists don't use that, we don't have fellowship anymore. They don't know where to come to or when to come. It's a great media for advertising. And it's also free. We had all these posters put up, which I saw around KK for my visit. How many tweets were there? That's actually how they get young people coming. So we have to use that media. Does that sort of answer the question? Sort of? Now that's another thing. If ever you're sitting here in front of the microphone and somebody asks you a question, please respect the questioner and ask them afterwards, was that okay? Did I answer the question? Because there's nothing worse than you ask a question and the person in front of the microphone, the speaker, doesn't answer it properly. Either because I misunderstood your question, or sometimes I avoided the main things you were asking. That's very disrespectful. So if there's any question I answer, and I didn't really get your point, please ask it again. Otherwise it's very disrespectful to you. At the back.
Good morning, Ajahn, and my fellow Buddhist believers. The question that I really like to ask you today, this morning, is this. In Malaysia, we have the Interfaith Committee to try and sort of come up with some kind of a uniform understanding among the different faiths in Malaysia. Now, from what we gather from the newspaper and the media, obviously we haven't heard a lot about them. But generally, the main point is we have to be harmonious. We have to respect one another's faith and so on and so forth. In light of political developments worldwide, particularly in the Arab Spring of this year, do you support that the Interfaith Committee should be a lot more vocal to try and tell the political leadership that the practice of democracy in all the country should follow the Interfaith Committee's recommendations? But in so doing, do you see the risk of something like what had happened in Iran back in the late 70s, where you have the theological or theocratic regime taking over? So you have this paradox. Obviously, if the political leadership were to follow the recommendation of the Interfaith Committee, all right, to let people respect one another's faith, and lead a more harmonious society. All right, this idea of letting go, getting rid of your attachment, is very much fundamental to Buddhism. We have just heard, reported, that Gary Speed, the footballer, took his own life. Wouldn't that be the ultimate step to get rid of attachments, as far as he's concerned? So how would Buddhism reconcile this sort of thing? And certain literature, especially when I heard people explain to young people, they say if you take your life, you will reborn, but you are reborn at the very lowest rank of the living things, perhaps like an amoeba. Is that the case? Thank you.
I'll answer your last question first. It was about 2 years ago. Of course, many people commit suicide all over the world, and Australia is no exception. And a family came to see me one evening. It was a Sri Lankan Buddhist family. That morning, they'd woken up to find their eldest son on the end of a rope. He'd hung himself that morning, committed suicide. And they were very distraught. And whenever a suicide happens, there were no signs. No one could understand why he did that. He was good at school, had lots of friends, but there he was, and no one could ask him why he did that anymore. And they too had heard these stupid statements by people who don't know what they're talking about in Buddhism, saying, oh, because he committed suicide, he'd go down to some hell realm and have a terrible rebirth. And it was because he was about to do his end of the school exams that I used that as a simile for explaining what really happened. Suppose you're doing your A-levels, which you do over here in Malaysia. You usually do about four subjects. Maybe every subject has two papers. Every paper has maybe 10 questions. If you mess up one question, you do a stupid, terrible answer to one question, does that mean you fail all your A-levels and can never get to university? Messing up one question doesn't stop you going to university. It's all the other questions you answer as well. In the same way, a person who commits suicide messes up the last question of their life. But you should always take into account all the other questions they've answered in the examination called their human life. All the other things which they have done and performed. Whether it's Mr. Gary Speed or that young boy. What else did they do in their life? And the parent said, he's a really good boy. He's always very kind, always very generous, never spoke back to his parents. So, well, there you are. He's answered all the other questions in the exam perfectly. It's just one question you got wrong. You can still go to university. You can still have a good rebirth. And they understood that answer. And they left my monastery at peace with themselves. And they always come back because they realize that this Buddhism actually helps them big time when it really needs it. They never need to go to see counselors and psychiatrists. They came to see me as well. Much cheaper, much better. Low price, high quality. That's why it's called marketing. Now, and as for the inter-faith or inter-religious dialogue in Malaysia, there are similar dialogues in places like Australia, but they only involve the moderates of every religion. Every religion has its moderates, but also has its extremists. And it's the extremists never join interfaith dialogues, but go in their pulpits or when they give sermons, and they said that this is not right, that we should meet each other. They say it's wrong that we should look upon people of different religions as equal to us. The real problem is with the people who don't go to those interreligious meetings. They're the problem. So there is, I know this in Australia, the Christians, the Muslims, the Hindus, the Jews who join in the interreligious activities, they're not the problem. It's the ones who don't come, who refuse to come, who denounce interreligious harmony. They're the ones who are the cause of the strife in our world. You only need one extremist to detonate a bomb. You can have 1,000 moderates, but it's that one extremist is the problem. There is a difficulty. The way to overcome that interreligious dialogue is important. But even more important than that is interreligious living. Not just the leaders meet together once a week or once a month, but the different people of different religions meeting together every day of their lives. And I mentioned that last night. One of the ways of avoiding such problems in our future is to do away with religious schools. No more Catholic schools, Buddhist schools, Islamic universities. Schools where Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus can grow up together, can play soccer together in the same team, make friendships together, study together at university, marry each other. There's one fellow in Singapore. He's a Buddhist. He's married to a Muslim. Their son is a Christian. And I say, wonderful. When you have a daughter, make sure she's a Hindu. Wouldn't that be inspiring? Why not? So, for me, that's one of the problems. Different religions are isolated. We just go to the same schools, we live in the same districts, the same kampongs. We only get to know our own group. So we grow up thinking that people of other religions are very different than us. When we grow up together, look, I was fortunate. My father was very poor. So we lived in a council flat, which is basically the lowest accommodation you can get in London. Except like, you know, being homeless. And so because it was a poor area, the school where I went to, the primary school, had lots of migrants. So you had Chinese people, Pakistani people, African people, people from Eastern Europe, all sorts of people. And I grew up with those kids. They were my friends. You know, you get into trouble together, you're playing the same soccer team together. So I got what they call colorblind ever since I was very young. How could you get angry, sort of a black person, when you're a best friend? How can you sort of discriminate against this Pakistani Muslim? You know, when, you know, we used to play soccer together. You couldn't do that. So, I found from my own personal experience, when you grow up together, you play together, you know, from all the different religions, harmony is made at the very earliest time when it's very necessary. Black people, yellow people, white people, pink people, brown people, spotted people, I don't care. If they play good soccer, they're in my team. Even like soccer is a great form of racial harmony. You know, when you have, even like the Premier League, Manchester United, I really can't figure out actually how they can communicate with each other because they're all from different nations. How can they say pass the ball when they have to know it in Spanish, in Mandarin? Because you get people in Korean, you get people from all different nationalities playing the same soccer team. It means they're friends together. Does that make sense to you? Am I answering your question? Okay. Very good. Yeah?
I think perhaps we can go further into this issue about suicides. How does that fit into the whole ideology of Buddhism? As he was mentioning, that by taking one's life in other religions is a big no-no. So how does Buddhism view it? Because nowadays, with the advancement of medicine, we live very long lives. And sometimes I'm just wondering whether the length of one's life really matters. Because let's say I have cancer and I'm given all these drugs to keep my life there. And it's in most countries, euthanasia is illegal. How does Buddhism view euthanasia, for example? Thank you.
Did the Buddha commit euthanasia? Didn't he? 3 months before his parinirvana, at the Chapala shrine, the Buddha abandoned his will to live. Ananda had the chance to invite the Buddha to please extend your life. But Ananda didn't take the opportunity. And so the Buddha gave up his life faculty. Another way of saying, he decided by his own will to die. Even eating the pork just before he passed away. The Buddha knew what he was doing. He had the psychic powers. He knew that would kill him. Wasn't that another example of him ending his own life? That's heretical sometimes, but as a Western monk I can say such things to make people think. There were many monks. One of those was a monk called Channa, who slit his own throat, committed suicide. And when Sariputta went to tell the Buddha that Channa was planning to do this, the Buddha said, Sariputta, Channa's death will be blameless. He was actually saying, in certain situations, ending your own life is not a sin. It's not bad. It's not bad karma. Because in Buddhism, it's why you do it is more important than what you do. The intention is the most important part of karma. Chetanaham kamang vadami, said the Buddha. Chetana, intention, that is the essence of karma, said the Buddha. It's the intention which gives it the moral black and whiteness. So it's not you commit suicide, it's why you do that. And that is recognized in our culture of all religions. If a Muslim commits suicide for a good cause, they're called a martyr. When a soldier sacrifices his life for his country, he's called a patriot. Each one of these, when a mother sacrifices her own life for her child, that's considered to be a wonderful act. There a person has willingly decided to die, taking a bullet for somebody else. That is suicide. Suicide, if you look in the dictionary, I looked it up about 6 months ago because I was arguing this point with someone, intentionally doing an act which causes your death. So intentionally doing an act knowing it's going to cause your death. So in many cases, people don't think widely enough. Suicide, by its definition in a dictionary, is often considered to be a noble act, if done for the right motives. And that opens up the question, a person who is very sick, no quality of life, who decides to take their own life, it's not evil or bad karma per se. You have to say why they did that. What was their motive? For about 6 months, in the Northern Territory of Australia, voluntary euthanasia was also legal. It was the first jurisdiction in our world which allowed legally assisted voluntary euthanasia. The first person to take advantage of that was a man called Mr. Dent, who was a Buddhist, an Australian Buddhist. I never met the man, but one of my monks did. And he was planning to do this, and his reason for taking voluntary euthanasia was this. He had one of these terrible modern diseases, which could last for many years, would mean he was bedridden, incontinent, had hardly any control over his limbs, was in constant pain, needed constant care and medication. And the prognosis was that this could go on for years. No sign of recovery, but many years of pain and discomfort. He said he could endure that, but what he could not endure was the fact that his wife had to give him almost constant attention and had no life for herself. He decided to go for voluntary euthanasia, not for his own benefit, but to free his own wife, so she did not need to care for him, so she could be free and have a good life. That was his reasoning. Whether you agree with that or not, that's why he took voluntary euthanasia, out of compassion for somebody else. Go on.
The person who died seems to be okay with that. I agree, your explanation is very acceptable. But unfortunately, what about the person who assisted the euthanasia? Because most of these people would be unable to do it themselves. They would need some help. Now, I understand there was this Australian case where the young man helped his mother in New Zealand, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And he's been held accountable for killing his mother. How does one handle that?
Yeah. How does one handle that? This is an ethical problem. Many judges, this is not the first time that someone has helped a family member. It has been the choice of the person dying. They ask the family member, please help me, but I will make that final decision. I'll press that final button. For that boy who helped his mum, I'm sure he feels he's always done the right thing, and he could probably be saying, look, I don't mind going to jail. Out of love for my mother, I've taken away her suffering, done what she wanted to do. But most judges would refuse to send such people to jail. It's happened so many times throughout Europe, UK especially, Australia, New Zealand. The judge has found them guilty, because he has to, it's the law, but said, you can go. I'm not going to give you a sentence. Because the judge knows there is no moral blame. When a judge, I'm not sure what happens in Malaysian law, in Australian law, the guilty verdict, you know, have no leeway there. If they've done the crime and it's according to the law, you have to say you're guilty, you did that. But the punishment is very often at the discretion of the judge or the magistrate. So he said, and one of the things they have to take into consideration is the moral blameworthiness of that act. And I think most people would agree, sort of assisting your mother commit euthanasia when it's her decision, she's got no quality of life, that's a huge difference between taking out a gun and you know, killing the woman who's sleeping with your husband. It's totally different. Because of that, the many jurisdictions, yeah, they have to record a guilty verdict, but they won't give a sentence. And many jurisdictions are trying to change that law. People keep trying to change the law because, for example, in Australia, 90% of the people want to have voluntary euthanasia decriminalised. So if that's what you do, the law doesn't get involved. It's not the sort of thing the law should be doing. If it's murder, yes. Please, prosecute. But voluntary euthanasia should be a personal choice, because most people understand that the moral dimension of that, they don't care Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, whatever, they realize that it doesn't feel wrong. It feels like it's a compassionate thing. You know, as a Buddhist, as a monk, when people ask me such questions, you know one of the things I do first of all? I put aside all the teachings of the Buddha I've ever learnt. And I feel that. Does that feel right or does that feel wrong? And every time voluntary euthanasia's come up, it actually feels right. It feels that I can understand there's nothing wrong with this. It's not evil. People do much, much worse things than that. And then I go back to the Buddhist teachings and look at the Buddhist teachings afresh and find actually there's nothing wrong with that according to the precepts. The first precept against killing is against killing somebody else, not about yourself. There was once a monk who wanted to commit suicide and jumped off a cliff. And the Buddha laid down a rule for the monks. Not you shouldn't try to commit suicide, but don't jump off cliffs. The reason was actually a guy walking underneath, and so he fell on the guy and killed the guy. And he survived. But there was there, where you would expect the Buddha to say you should not try and commit suicide, it wasn't there at all. The rule is, you know, not to cause other people's death. But your own body, that's your own karma, their rules don't go. Any other questions you have? It's really, in Malaysia, is abortion illegal? Always? Say if a person is raped or is, the mother might die. Is it always illegal? So who knows? Oh yeah, as a gynecologist, you will know.
Ajahn, there is an exception to that. It is illegal to do abortions in Malaysia. Medical indication, as certified by two independent doctors, we are allowed to do abortions.
Well, there we go, there's exceptions. Should there be exceptions for euthanasia too? To be consistent, why not? Anyway, that's just throwing things out. Many people say in extreme circumstances that we should have abortions. In the same argument, in extreme situations, one should be allowed to take one's own life. In extreme situations. Anyway, another question.
Ajahn, I just want to ask on the question of morality. We nowadays hear about gay rights,
yeah.
Gay priests, gay bishops. And then yeah. We are supposed to go to church and listen to the gay bishops and the gay priests. And the similar thing, I think there's a trend among the other religions on the gay rights. What is your take on this thing?
Okay. It does say in the Christian Bible that homosexuality is an abomination. And so because it's written very clearly, sort of in, I think it's in the Old Testament, it means that for Jews, for Christians, and also for Muslims, there's no real chance to actually to say anything about it because it's there in black and white. There's nothing like that at all in Buddhism. And in fact, what Buddhism says is may all beings be happy and well. And gay people are beings. So what Buddha is saying, may all straights, gays, lesbians, transgenders, may all beings be happy and well. So Buddhism wishes all gay people happiness and well-being. Not trying to change them, but actually accepting and respecting them. And I say this as a former heterosexual who is afraid of gay people. Growing up, I had girlfriends. And if there was a gay boy, I was really terrified. But once I became a monk, I got to know many gay people. And I remember one time giving a talk. At the end of the talk, this leader of the gay community in Perth came up to me and said, "Thank goodness that Buddhism is being kind to us. Because religion has been so cruel to us." And he was maybe in his 60s. And when he said that, I had a huge surge of compassion. Because this was a man who was gay, born gay, will always be gay, and was afraid and rejected by society. He wanted to have a religion which would love him, only found hate. And I thought it's a wonderful thing that Buddhism could be compassionate enough to say, okay, you can be a gay, you can be a member of our community. And to this day I say, I'd rather have a gay couple in a committed relationship as my disciple than a heterosexual male who has a mistress. A heterosexual male who has a mistress is breaking his precepts and is hurting his wife. I will not respect you if you do that. But if you are a gay person in a committed relationship with another person of your same gender, you'll be my disciple, and I'm proud to have you as a disciple. I don't know if you've met any gay people, or you may be gay yourself. Please meet someone who's gay and ask them what it feels like. And then you'll find that these are human beings in pain, being rejected. All you women here who fought for years to try and have some equality and respect from the males, so you can go to school, you can go to university, you can go to a job at the highest levels and still even get equal pay, which you probably still don't get. You may do the same work as a man, get paid less. Is that fair? You have fought against discrimination, which is unfair. Now, you would know what gay people feel like. What women felt like 20 years ago. Afraid, scared, discriminated against. To me as a Buddhist, that's not good enough. Some years ago, in Perth, there was an article which was reprinted from the Daily Telegraph newspaper in UK. And in that newspaper article, it was quoting the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama was quoted as saying, if you're a homosexual, you can't be a Buddhist, period. And when that was reprinted in Australia, I got many calls from members of my Buddhist community who were gay. I said, is this true? Please tell us it's not true. Because at last they found a religion which accepted them and loved them. And now they had doubts from the Dalai Lama saying it's not true. So immediately I got pen and paper and wrote an article to the newspaper, said, with all respect to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he's wrong. And I know my sutras, I know my Pali. I'm not just a meditation teacher, I've done the studies, I know what I'm talking about. I can argue with any scholar. The Buddha never rejected gays. And when I mentioned that to them, all the gay community, they wrote letters to me. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. For a moment I thought that the doors for religion are totally closed to us. And you've kept them open. Thank you so much. And as a result of that, I was very honored to be invited to the Gay Pride Breakfast in Perth. I gave a little speech. They knew I wasn't gay, that I was heterosexual before, now a monk. But out of thank you for me, they invited me to an annual celebration of a gay pride breakfast. So I could actually say, look, you know, that I'm very happy to have you as my friends. Very happy to have you as Buddhists. One day, you'll have a daughter or a son who comes up to you and says they're gay. Please love them. Say, you're my daughter, you're my son. Wonderful. I'll support you. Never be embarrassed. The gay people of our world have had huge, huge contributions to society. The number of artists, musicians, Tchaikovsky, gay, has done amazing things. Even these huge, hunky athletes. The great Australian swimmer, Michael Klim, is gay. So many of these amazing people. And that's who they are. And you would never think they're not effeminate. These huge, hunking, macho guys. So please, out of compassion, at least with one religion at least, can say, gays, you're welcome. Out of love. So please, if I'm passionate about this, it's because as a Buddhist leader, I dislike discrimination. It's one of the reasons, as you all know, I fought hard to be able to have ordination of women in our Theravada tradition. So it's bhikkhunis, not just bhikkhus, but bhikkhunis. We've got a wonderful bhikkhuni in the back there, Mahayana, but where's the Theravada bhikkhunis? So instead of complaining, I did something about it. Got into trouble, but now we've got bhikkhunis. Yeah?
Yeah, so from judging from what you say, so it's okay in the future we see a Ajahn who is a gay preacher coming and talk to us and...
Sure, but as long as if they're a monk, they're not gay, they're not heterosexual, they're celibate. That's actually what I said to the gay pride breakfast. And I said, you think you are deviant. I'm more deviant than all of you because I have no sex at all. So I cracked a joke. But once you're a monk or a nun, that means no sex. So if an Ajahn comes up here, they may have been gay before. Fine. I was heterosexual before. Fine, but I'm not heterosexual now. I don't have girlfriends. I'm a monk. I'm celibate. So because of that, whatever teacher comes up there, they're not gay, they're not heterosexual. They're monks or nuns. But if a lay teacher comes up and they're gay, fine. As long as they're a good gay, they're not a sexual predator, they don't sort of sleep with underage kids. But I don't care, you're heterosexual or homosexual, if you abuse sexuality and go and take advantage of children who are underage, that is morally wrong. That is unethical. That is breaking the precepts. The third precept, kamesamicharchara, is not just adultery. It's actually sleeping with underage, disabled, mentally disabled people. People who aren't mature or capable enough of giving legitimate consent. So that's the precepts. It's not just adultery. But also maybe you may be a teacher and sleeping with your student. That is also breaking the five precepts. It's taking advantage of somebody. That makes sense to you? Great. Yeah, another one. And thank you for bringing up real issues. And hopefully you can understand that Buddhism can address these issues without embarrassment. Yeah.
Good morning, Ajahn. By the same note, when a baby was baptized as a Christian, and when that baby grows up, and she wants to follow another religion, what is your view on that?
When the baby is baptized, the baby is not asked whether it wants to be baptized or not. It is done without that baby's free choice, therefore it does not count. A good example of that. I was baptized as a Christian when I was very small. I can't remember it at all. My parents never asked me. It's just what was done. But that does not make me a Christian. Rituals don't make you a Christian or Buddhist or whatever. You become a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim in here, in your heart. That's who you are. You can't make a person a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim. They decide. They know that that's who they are. That again, Article 18, Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Has Malaysia signed up to that UNDHR? is widely accepted as a wonderful document of morality and goodness and compassion. The freedom of religion. And what I often say, because I'm a religious leader, yes, religions should have their freedoms, but also we should have the freedom from religion as well. Not the freedom of religion, the freedom from religion, because religion sometimes gets involved in some areas where it causes more harm than good. And France, best France, has actually done that, well done, and has a very reasonably harmonious results. Our last question. Okay, and thank you for, again, this is following the topic of problems with Buddhism in the modern era. So actually confronting questions of our modern times. Yep.
Hello, Ajahn, you were saying just now in the Buddhism religion, all the practitioners should be speaking one voice, compassion and so on. So how do you deal with the extremists in each religion so that you can portray a united front? Or, as I see from the news and the TV, what happens is the political leaders, they use the moderates, the majority in the religion, to come and speak against the extremists and condemn them. And it leads to no end in conflict.
Again, one of the difficulties is the media has to take some responsibility, because the newspapers, radios and televisions now report the acts of the extremists. The moderates have a very soft voice. It's the extremists who shout the loudest. They are newsworthy. People watch explosions on TV. They watch the latest terrorist attack on TV. They never report an interfaith harmonious meeting. It's not newsworthy. That is one of the problems. The media has to take some responsibility for giving what Margaret Thatcher called the extremists the oxygen of publicity. Without that publicity, the extremists would soon lose their following. If the media never reported the terrorist acts, if they never reported the violent preachers, they would have no audience. They would disappear. A lot of times people do violent acts for the publicity of it. So that's one way of dealing with the problem. It's not just the moderates were always in the majority. It's also the education. Now, what is real Islam? What is real Buddhism? And so that when there's a wider education, there's always a much more moderate result. When people get to know what the Buddha really taught, what Jesus really taught, and know what probably the Prophet Muhammad really taught, I think you usually find out that these are very loving, compassionate, merciful people. And if we focus on those messages rather than the extremist ones, then that would stop all the lay people following and giving donations to these extremists. It's also, obviously, one of the reasons why extremists get traction in the world is because the governments become so corrupt that people are so poor and discriminated against in many areas of our world that this is a last resort. The extremists offer a solution to the problems of the world when governments don't seem to be offering any solutions. And so they get many supporters who think, follow the extremists and we can solve the problems of corruption, inequality and other difficulties of our world. And of course it never happens. You follow the extremists, you get the same old problems again. Now, as in, for example, Iran. Concerned about those Buddhists. It is simply un-Australian the manner in which they are so kind, gentle and tolerant, never seeking headlines or complaining about how they are treated. Can it quickly be addressed before it spreads? That's a wonderful compliment, using satire. Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. You talk about modern problems. I think one of the issues is about cults. Even Buddhism seems to have their cults as well. I understand certain groups, for example, would say this is the most powerful, believe in us, if you pray to using this phrase, you will get to whatever you want. I think the basic issue is you get whatever you want, be it wealth, be it position, jobs that they want, so on. How do you feel about this?
Well, research shows, the evidence proves it does not work. That's what the evangelical Christians say, believe in Jesus and your cancer will go. You'll meet the most beautiful girl in the world. You'll be rich beyond your wildest dreams, blah, blah, blah. And of course, you know, you just go to the hospital here in KK, you find as many Christians and Buddhists, Muslims and Soka Gakkai people also have cancer as well. Basically, it is pandering to the stupidity and gullibility of the human race. So please, let's increase our education. So people look at the evidence. It does not work. It is false claims. I don't know in the West, if you advertise a product, such as a computer, and you falsely advertise it, it doesn't produce what you say it produces, you can get taken to court and sued. Is that the case in Malaysia? The same should be with religions. If it doesn't work, they should take these religions to court. So you advertise, you know, it will solve all my problems and make me rich and get me my job. It hasn't worked. Sue them. Because these are cults, sects. And you should know what a sect is. One of the signs of a sect is say, we are the only way, all the other people have got it wrong. And you mustn't read anything about anybody else. Never go to any other temple. Don't associate with any other religion except our cult. If that ever happens, those are warning signs. As a Buddhist, look, if there's a very wonderful Muslim teacher coming to KK next week, please listen to him or her. If they're saying something useful, go for it. If you like Western food, eat Western food. Eat sort of local food. Eat Chinese food. Eat Indian food. A varied diet is very good for you. Same in religion as well. You see an Ang Mo monk, Chinese nun comes tomorrow, a Zen monk, go and listen to them. And that means it's not a cult. So know the warning signs. Very good. Okay. Sadhu! Sadhu!